from Allies to the Visionary Activist Show, and I'm your weaver of context, Caroline Casey. So it is the Halloween waxing full moon, and we are honored to have a longtime ally of mine, Sally Quinn, as our guest. But first, a little weaving of context to most welcome her in many ways. So we are doing magic with her book, Finding Magic. She's the author of this spirited political memoir, and she has consulted with me since 1978, so we have an interesting bringing culturally influential magic even into the political realm. So it is the waxing full moon. It is continues to be the Day of the Dead. True Halloween is imminent, one of the four cross-quarter holidays. It will actually be November 7th, where the veils between the living and the dead are most open. And we do need a wildly diverse, welcoming team, you know, everywhere in the world. I like the great novel Power Game by Jamaican author Perry Henzel, who made the movie The Harder They Come. He delineates a cast of characters needed to pull off good cultural change. So he says, we need the ganja-smoking Rastas, we need one ally in the Pentagon to call off the invasion, one or two ethical investment bankers to secretly fund the thing, and more. So in that spirit, we are hosting Sally Quinn, Washington Global Political, founder of On Faith, a player, the widow of Ben Bradley, editor of the Washington Post during Watergate and more, mega connected in that realm, but also in the spirit realm. May we all cross-pollinate and syncretize between worlds, and to re-wed the realm of politics, which was always meant to be, in its long-ago originating impulse, maybe with wolves, a dedication to collective well-being. So I have been Sally's astrological ally, guide, always aspiring to guide her to her own feisty and fabulous autonomy since 1978. Holy moly. So we do have a unique opportunity unfurling before us where all of her is welcome, which is part of this show where all parts of everybody are welcome, ollie ollie income free, because we all of us really are dedicated to the essence of ritual magic, to spiral expanded wisdom and tolerance into the memosphere. There are moments in this memoir, Finding Magic, of authentic earned transcendence that we will bring into play, woven betwixt narrative of an amazing life of grace and privileged access and challenge, you know, to care for her beautiful son, Quinn, whom we will honor, whom I've always thought of as a Taurian nature spirit, but who was diagnosed with many challenges, and Ben Bradley in his final years from brilliance to dementia that I would also call Neptune Pluto transits, and a great amount of honesty and self-bearing. So it's a rip-roaring read. So welcome, Sally.
Thank you, Caroline.
Yeah, this is a fun continuing of our adventures. So first I have to say, as I've said to you before, I've gotten yes, a lot of attention because you do honor me in the book. A lot of people are listening to you on Audible because you read the whole book, did you?
Yes, I did. Yeah.
Wow. So, and one of the things that's remarkable in the physical book, and I just have to say to everybody, the physical sensual book is beautiful. It's this smoky purple cover with embossed moon, and you know, it's really gorgeous. And I did, I read the whole thing after dental surgery and a mild trance of medical cannabis to heal it. So it was a great way to go through the whole thing going, I know that person, and well, whatever, I didn't, there's that. But many beautiful passages that I hope to bring up. But you begin, you begin with Mary Oliver's poem, Summer Day, which is...
which I love, great. And which says everything.
Yeah. And let me just bring in the last... Sorry, say?
Yeah.
Well, I'll just bring in the last thing because it's poignant. It's mm-hmm. Mary Oliver begins, you know, as a Virgo, like Ben, we'll play with this, to be able to tease from small things large things. So her poem begins in detail praising, you know, a grasshopper at the wistful end of summer and ends, doesn't everything die at last and too soon? Tell me, what is it you plan to do with your one wild and precious life?
So, when I read that,
your book is really a response to that.
It just blew me away because I thought, this is what I'm writing about. this is what I'm writing about. What am I going to do with my one wild and precious life? And, you know, what have I done with my one wild and precious life? And now I'm 76, and I still feel like that. I feel like I've got at least another 25 good years, but Caroline, you would know that better than anybody. You've seen
into your hundreds. Well, because, you know, we will talk about this in private as well, but the boundary is intriguingly thin because your book is so revelatory. And I just wanted to read one incredibly, you know, honest passage that you write. You say quite belatedly and sadly, "It began dawning on me that learning about oneself, understanding oneself, might actually lead to becoming a better and kinder, more empathic person. Mm-hmm. I had bought into the public impression of me as an ambitious, superficial, self-centered person, and I didn't like the caricature I was seen as, and I didn't like whom I seemed to be becoming. And then I came to understand that I wasn't that person. I was a good person and also an authentic one," which is, That's a great offering.
Well, you know, also, I didn't do that without help. I had you telling me that I wasn't that person. And I had a wonderful psychiatrist telling me that I wasn't that person. And I had Ben and Quinn and my mother and father telling me that I wasn't that person. And so there was always that moment. I mean, I write in the book that this woman came up after I'd started writing for the Washington Post, and I was doing, profiles of people, and sometimes they weren't flattering, but I never misquoted anybody. I mean, I always would write what they said to me, and then they didn't like it very much sometimes, or regretted it. And Henry Kissinger's favorite line about Maxine Cheshire, who was our gossip columnist, and he said, "Maxine Cheshire makes you want to commit murder, and Sally makes you want to commit suicide." But I felt that I was writing what was true, and that somehow that if it wasn't always flattering, that people thought that I was mean or unfair or not nice, particularly if their own, you know, if their friends were the subject of my profiles. And then, you know, so there was that perception of me as being this sort of very tough person, and that's not who I was. But I would sit down at the computer, the typewriter in those days, and I would write these pieces. And I had all my quotes out there, and I would simply quote them, and I would write about what they said and what they did. And actually, the majority of pieces that I wrote were very favorable to people, but those aren't the ones that people remember.
But also, I do remember, people do remember that. I remember Zbigniew Brzezinski, the interview, which was very... Thank you. You might remind our listeners who he was.
Well, he was the Jimmy Carter National Security Advisor, and then later became the father of Mika Brzezinski. And
right.
I did a three-part series on him, and I think it was very revealing, but at the end of the series, I made a terrible mistake, which I had seen a photo of him and was told that it was something... It was actually something that wasn't true, that my eyes deceived me because it looked like it was true, and I wrote about it, and it was probably the worst experience I ever had in my life journalistically.
Oh, sorry to bring that up. That's not the part I remembered. I remembered you accurately reporting his inappropriately flirtatious manner also in pertinent to now, and also as you in the book remind us that John Tower, a political person, tried to rape you when you were a 20-year-old
in the back of a cab.
Person.
Yeah, yeah.
Yes.
No. I mean, John Tower was he was a very conservative from Texas, and my parents were my father was anyway politically conservative, and Barry Goldwater's closest friend. And by the way, I adored Barry Goldwater. I thought he was a fabulous person, and he was misunderstood by a lot of people. Although I think many liberals came to love him toward the end of his life. But anyway, they introduced me to John Tower, and he asked me to have... I was a theater major at Smith College and minoring in politics, and so he seemed particularly interested in me, and because he had taught theater, interestingly enough, in Texas, and then he was a senator, and asked me for lunch, and then at the last minute, he sort of, oops, I can't do lunch, can you, you know, we'll have to do dinner and meet me in my office, and I went to the, I was very nervous, because I just, you know, I didn't know what to do, but I also thought, I can't say no to dinner, because then I would be implying that he had ulterior motives. And he took me to a restaurant, and it was horrible. He started pawing at me, and I tried to, you know, we walked out, and I tried to get a cab, and he literally took me by the arm and dragged me across the street into this very murky nightclub upstairs in this little dark room with French love seats, and ordered a drink, and then he really started coming on to me, and I finally, I said, let me read your palm. He had the little tiny sweaty fingers, but I was trying to get his hands off me, and when I talked and talked and talked, and then he ordered another drink, and I took that opportunity to jump up and run down the stairs and hail a cab, and he ran after me and said, I'm coming with you. I said, no, no, Senator, I live at Fort Myer, Virginia, and you live on Capitol Hill, so I'll just take this alone. And he jumped in the cab with me and jumped on top of me and started trying to take my clothes off. And and I was screaming and telling the cab driver to, you know, and the cab driver was going crazy because he was from Southern and he didn't know what to do. And he heard me say, Senator, please. And he was going 100 miles an hour and got me home, you know, screeched to the front of my quarters. And I, you know, was fighting him off. But he was strong. He was tiny, but really strong. But anyway, he did not succeed at what he was trying to accomplish. And I jumped out. And I don't think, I think at that point, you know, he was afraid the general, my father was a general, the general or the MPs, the military police, would come after him. So I ran into the house and just burst into tears.
Right.
And I didn't tell anybody for a long time. I was so ashamed because I thought I had done it. It was somehow my fault, you know.
Well, there's a lot of this going on in the collective now, and we do want to tie it into the whole larger anything that's anywhere is everywhere, you know, the myriad forms of of inquisition, either you know, grotesque and personal in that manner, or the suppression, you know, or dissing of your own affinity and many of our affinity with wonder, with mystery, with magic, which so reading your book, it was great, you know, again in our quirky long term, because I have beside me here typed letters I wrote you in August of 1982 and all kinds of things, some of which have really great things in them, but that idea of you know, the dissing of your own ardent spirituality. But as I was going through our file and reading your book, I go, by God, you really are who we've been rooting for the whole time, you know, because we make mention to your, and I didn't know, I mean, because some of the details, you know, I'd always been speaking to your pragmatic mystic sorceress ally of Ben Bradley's self, and then, you know, you delineate, you know, your affinity with Vudun from, you know, growing up in Georgia, and then all these, you know, things, you know, in many ways, and syncretizing always with your curiosity. So it was curious when in the book you had said that you went through a period of calling yourself an atheist. I go, I don't know anything about Sally that's an atheist, but that was part of your because you were always interested in tarot and astrology and mystery and more going on, right? Yeah.
But Caroline, so, you know, the word atheist really it certainly in those days, and not so much anymore, really had to do with organized religion. It had to do with a rejection of organized religion and a rejection of, you know, this sort of standardized version of God, you know, the sort of personal God that and the Father of Jesus and, you know, the person we all pray to. And we may pray, I pray all the time, but not to a personal God who I think is going to make things better for me, and you know, with the hell with everybody else, you know, in Somalia or Rwanda or, you know, wherever they might be, Syria, wherever they might be suffering. But I became an atheist when I was 4 years old, and I write about this in the book. My father was in the army, and he was in Germany, and he was liberated Dachau, the concentration camp, and had his staff photographer take photographs and made a scrapbook and brought it home and hid it. And I found it and was just absolutely appalled. I couldn't believe it, and asked my father, and I said, "Daddy, did God know about this?" He explained what had happened, and he said, "Yes." And I said, "How could he let this happen?" And my father said, "Well, you know, God works in mysterious ways." And I was just distraught, and I cried all night long, but I thought, All I could think about was these little Jewish children and their parents praying to God to save them. I was praying to the same God, and look what happened to them. So if he could let that happen to him, then why not me? And so I decided there was no such thing as God, and I was four, and I never told anybody because I was too ashamed and embarrassed to tell people, scared to tell people I didn't believe in God. And I was 13 when I learned the word atheist, and I was so relieved to know that I wasn't the only one, that there were actually people out there who didn't believe in God. And then, you know, when my father was in Korea, I got very sick. I was in Tokyo General Hospital, and they were bringing all the wounded soldiers in. And, you know, these kids, 17, 18, 19, with their limbs blown off and blinded and burned, you know, half to death. And then I was evacuated on a hospital plane with the most seriously wounded to Texas. And there were, the plane had litters, five high, three rows of litters. And these soldiers were all screaming and crying in agony and bleeding. The blood was dripping down on the floor from the litters, and they were dying and sort of zipped up in body bags. And my mother went up and down the aisles, slipping in the blood and trying to comfort them. And they were crying for their mothers and begging to die or begging not to die. And it was just horrible. And again, I thought, there can't be a God who would let this happen. And so all of my life, I did, and until I started my religion website On Faith at the Washington Post 11 years ago, I was still considering myself an atheist. Although I did have a conversation with my friend John Meacham, who was at Newsweek editor at the time, now is a Pulitzer Prize winning historian and a religion scholar. And he said, "You're not an atheist." And I said, "Yes, I am." And he said, "No, because it's a negative word, and you're not a negative person. And, you know, it means that you deny the existence of God, and you don't know. And besides, you know, you say you're an angry atheist, but how can you be angry at God if you don't believe in God?" And he gave me a list of books to read to go out and say, you know, learn something about religion, then come back and tell me you're an atheist. And so I started reading all these books, and I was absolutely riveted. I just became consumed with the whole idea and subject of religion. And then I took a trip around the world to study the great faiths. And I went to 13 countries. And I learned so much about not only religion, but the practice of religion. And so much, a lot of it, I rejected, but so much of it did have such meaning for me. And the more I learned about religion, the more I learned that there were so many different ways that you could worship or ways that you could practice your faith, and so many different ways to believe. And I'm very pluralistic. I mean, my feeling is that whatever you believe is fine, as long as it doesn't hurt anybody. And I, you know, the basic tenets of all of the religions are the golden rule, you know,
there's a wonderful quote. There's a wonderful quote that says, "The God that an atheist denies never existed." And so we go, right. Yeah. So the rejection of orthodoxy and your rejection of all the forms of inquisition, whether it's Senator Towers trying to rape you in the cab or the suppression of the mystical or the war on the earth, which is at its kind of height with the Dementors. And a quirky thing just to put to one side, there's a very democratic show, Sally, you can go anywhere you want. But I did want to bring in, you know, that, you know, Steve Bannon, you know, is a very educated esotericist in a spooky way. He really knows, he's studied the power of symbols and things. And so it behooves us, and I want to honor your book and To and Fro. Well, yeah, but also it behooves us, you know, it's said that, you know, we've talked about this many times, that the purpose of ritual magic is to spiral into group mind, expanded wisdom and tolerance.
Yeah.
So even more now, and I love your life and where it's going, but we'll talk about that more later, you know, you know, it's the idea for all of us to preemptively, you know, invite the best of people rather than the mob mind kind
right.
of out there where esoterica has been you know, hoodwinked. But I do love, and you know, so there's the atheist dynamic. But very early in book, and I've highlighted so many things. but you do have authentic moments of real transcendence. Your Christmas in Greece, you know, and you say you had the oddest sensation as if I were watching flashbacks of my life, except I was seeing flash forwards. My whole emotional future passed before me, and I felt everything good and bad that afternoon that I've felt since. Exhilaration, devastation, fear, strength, pride, envy, despair, peace, love many times over, hate, fear, apprehension, need, lust, anticipation, guilt, excitement, shame, greed. This is all very Cancerian. A full menu of feelings, uncertainty, ambition, insecurity, compassion, giving, nurturing. And you say you could go on, but the kaleidoscope in your brain kept twisting and turning, showing you various rearrangements of your emotions. And you said you were terrified and thrilled. It was a true psychic experience.
Mm-hmm.
And that gave you enormous emotional strength. So there was always that, right?
Yeah. Yeah, well, I was 13, I think, at the time. And it's been, it was interesting because I knew what to expect, and not what specifically, but I've never had an emotion or a feeling or a thought since then that did not feel familiar to me or uncomfortable in some way. I've always felt very comfortable because I know I already experienced it, that moment in my life, in some odd way.
Right. It's like you were tripping without any external
impetus.
Yeah. It was right. It was endogenous, intrinsic to you, which we love, and you know, and because part of your journey that you narrate. That is important also is, you know, what gets us through the underworld? What gets us through when many things seem to be falling apart? And I do love in our conversing, you know, through the tribulations of beautiful Quinn's birth and his health crises and then his growing up, as I've always felt him to be a nature spirit. But you would say, well, how will society treat him?
Mm-hmm.
And then we would speak deeply. It's like, well, Sally, then part of your task is to make the culture that would accept Quinn and all such beings, right? That this caring and nurturing part of you really bringing out the best.
Well, he was, you know, he was born with a hole in his heart, as you know, and had open heart surgery when he was 3 months old. And then he, you know, he was diagnosed at age 14 with a syndrome called velocardiofacial syndrome, which has about 187 manifestations of various medical problems, and he was severely learning disabled as a child and was in and out of surgery in Children's Hospital until he was about 16. But one of the things that I always told him was that he was very special, and you know, you talk about special children and special needs, and it sounds trite now, but in those days, you know, that was, he's 35, so that wasn't necessarily part of the language of children who were, you know, the people used to call them retarded, but he wasn't, he was learning disabled. And he's trying to change that word now to learning differences because he hates the word disability.
Perfect.
Because he feels he's not
Yes.
disabled. But what Ben and I always did, first of all, is give him enormous amount of love and confidence. And, you know, who couldn't be confident if if Ben Bradley told you that you were the person he admired more than anyone in the whole world. And he knew he was the most loved child in the world. But we also talked very openly about his learning disabilities from the very beginning and never tried to hide it and would say, oh, you know, Quinn's LD and, you know, goes to the lab school because he went to special schools all his life. And told him that, you know, you can do anything you want to do. And I remember when his closest friend got accepted early to Harvard, and Quinn has no malice in him. I mean, he was so happy for his friend, but he felt dejected that he knew he would never be able to go to Harvard. And I said, but you know, you've got a gift that nobody else has. You have this ability to help other people because you are so empathetic. You know what it's like. And I said, you know, the fact is that you're lucky that you're learning disabled because you can use that for the rest of your life and you can make a huge difference. And he has, because he started a website for young adults with learning disabilities. He works at the National Center for Learning Disabilities, and he interviews celebrities who are LD and people who are working on the issues, and he goes around and he does television and he makes speeches, and he's made a big difference, because the motto of his website is own it, you know, and he has always been totally open about his own disabilities and the things he makes fun of them, you know, he makes fun of himself and says, oh my God, you won't believe what I did. I mean, he's in London now on a business on a trip to he's being honored in London and the Royal Society of Medicine and Oxford by these neurologists because of how much work he's done for learning disabilities. And but you know, he screws up. So he was supposed to go Sunday night, and I, you know, said, do you have your passport? Do you have your wallet? Do you have your phone? Do you have your money? Do you have your medicine? Do you have everything? You know, yes, Mom, get off my back. I can do it. And so the next morning I emailed him and said, tell me you arrived safely in London. And he called me and he said, I'm home. I said, what happened? He said, I took the wrong passport to the airport. Well, that's what his life is, you know? And I just sort of went, oh. And he said, Mom, this is my life, you know? I'll be on the plane tonight, you know? And he understands that one day he's absolutely brilliant, and the next day he's walking into walls. I mean, it's just up and down and up and down. He knows that. He's learned to live with it. He's totally accepting of that and who he is. And, you know, he just doesn't get depressed. He doesn't get dejected ever. It's just extraordinary.
No, he's wonderfully vital. And as you bring up, he's done great good for others. And we do like to put on our altar of desirable mystery, you know, that redemption comes from brewing medicine for others. And and I just want to bring up another passage from your book, Finding Magic, which is apt right now. You're out somewhere and you go, your body seemed to be lifted up in some kind of embrace, like being held and coddled and stroked. I felt loved and cherished, you write. Also felt tiny as I gazed up at the universe. There was such power there. I wanted to be part of it. I wanted to be swallowed up in it. I had a real longing for it. I wanted to understand it. And then I realized that I was. I did. I had. I understood that there was something bigger than me, that I would be taken care of, that I was loved, that I would be all right. Some people might say that I'd seen God or at least felt a presence. I wouldn't put it that way. I would say rather that I had witnessed true mystery, and not for the last time, you write, which is beautiful. And that's what you're saying also comes forth, you know, you as a Cancer, right, incarnation of the moon, Big Mama, and I do love an ally saying Cancer's just a Scorpio and a house goat, yeah. And just as fierce as anybody, you know. But these parts of you that come from the not glamorous glitzy, but from the caring and tending and loving Quinn, who does so much great good, and from, you know, I just saw you at the fete honoring yourself, and you spoke about, you know, the difficulty of Ben's dementia, from brilliance into this dementia, but many happy times, difficulties that you worked through, and sadness, but then You did say it was the happiest time between you, this tending, mm-hmm. these last yeah. moments.
And our 43 years together, those last 2 years when he was really in a serious decline, I said that it was the most spiritual time of my life. And I didn't start writing the book, although I'd had a book contract, until after Ben died, because I just didn't have anything in me. I couldn't write. But after he died, a couple weeks later, I thought, I now have to write this book. I'd sign a contract years ago.
So hold that yeah. thought. We're going to take a very brief okay. break. Our guest today is Sally Quinn. She's author of Finding Magic, a spiritual memoir, and we'll be right back after a very short break.
She shook the constellation that dazzled them crossed his eyes. She shook the constellation that dazzled them crossed his eyes. She showered his head with quasar and made his tortoise cry.
Off and down.
Chanty, 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 come blow my chanty home. Chanty, chanty, come blow my chanty home. Telegraph my indigo sky ship, make its voyage long.
Now get down.
Welcome back, allies, to the Visionary Activist Show. I'm your weaver of context, Caroline Casey, and our guest today is Sally Quinn, author of her spiritual memoir, Finding Magic, which is a great multi-nuanced narrative through our cultural, political history, through her personal life, teased out into pertinence for us. Really. And you can find that, just Google search Finding Magic, and it will come right up, this very, very beautiful, physically beautiful book. And I loved when I said that to you, Sally. You said, I did all of that myself. You said,
I designed the book cover. Myself. Yeah. I knew exactly what I wanted it to look like. And it's a spiritual book too. I mean, even though down at the bottom and in the dusk you can see the outline of Washington and the Capitol and the Washington Monument. And as you have said so often, Caroline, Washington is a spiritual hardship post. But I think that you can find
right.
magic anywhere, and I've certainly found it here, which may make some people surprised.
Let me toss that back to you, because it is so important. You now, this book now, as part of all of our journey, which is the larger planet saying, now is the time, Ollie income free, for imagination, wonder, spirituality, to come forward unshamed, uninquisitioned, unabashed, And you have this other great Rilke quote right at the beginning, live your questions now, and perhaps even without knowing it, you will live along some distant day into your answers, which is part of the outline of your book, yeah?
Well, and it's what's happened to me, too. I've had questions all my life. Doesn't mean I'm not questioning. I continue to question. There are many things I know that I will never know the answers to. But I've found a lot of answers along the way, and it certainly made my life a lot easier. And I mean, one of the things that I question all about my being an atheist and what I really believed. And once I decided that I did believe in a creator, because I couldn't imagine, my little mind couldn't wrap itself around the idea that first there was nothing and then there was something. So I was a figure that I had to. That I did believe in a creator, in something or someone or it or whatever, who created the universe. But it wasn't someone I prayed to, in a personal way. But it clearly for me was a higher power, and something that I felt when I, in moments of transcendence or moments of, where I felt that I was in touch with the divine. And I've had many of those moments throughout my life, and a lot of them, the book is divided into three sections: magic, mystery, and meaning. And through magic and through mystery, I finally came to an understanding of what really gave my life meaning. But part of that was through this sort of occult upbringing that I'd had from my, you know, Savannah, Georgia roots and all of that, and the sort of early belief in all of these things, the psychic phenomenon and certainly astrology, and I love the tarot and palmistry, and my mother is psychic. Her mother was, her Aunt Ruth was, my sister and I have some psychic abilities, as you know. I'm not terribly psychic, but I have these moments, these flashes. But I came to realize, and certainly this is one of the things that stood out to me in traveling around the world and seeing how many people believed in mysticism, in mystery, in magic, and that was part of their faith. And so I one of the things that I, you know, people used to joke, you know, all my friends would call me witchy, and, you know, they'd sort of talk about Sally and her psychic, you know, thing and astrology, and they're sort of with great humor, affectionate humor, but sort of dismissive, including Ben, who all thought it was all nonsense, although I have to say, Caroline, that every time I went to see Ben, I would come back, and he would sort of scoff at me for going to see an astrologer, although he adored you personally. But I would come back from these sessions with you, and Ben would say, "What'd you say about me? What'd you say about me?"
You know? Right.
But it became clear to me that there were all these mysteries, and that there's another whole realm, or maybe many realms, that are not defined by institutional religions, and that they had been given short shrift. I mean, they had been dismissed or even looked upon with contempt. And and I remember when Nancy Reagan, you remember, she had an astrologer.
Oh, yes. I caught a lot of the random press for no reason at that time. Yeah,
right. Yeah, and she had an astrologer decide on the taking off of the plane, you know, what minute, second that Air Force One should take off, her astrologer would tell her when to go. And I was asked to write a piece about it for the op-ed page of the Washington Post defending her, and I wouldn't do it because for many reasons. But the thing was, I felt sorry for her because her husband had just been shot, you know, and she was relying on, you know, whatever you do to reach out to help you with your fear and your grief and all of that. But the fact is that astrology has been very important to me in my life, and it's been very meaningful, and it has helped enormously. So I began to feel toward the end of writing this book that all of these things that I believed in that were not what you would call, you know, mainstream religions were just as legitimate as anything else that anyone believed, because having studied all these religions, I saw that they were all magic. You know, all religion is about magic. I mean, if you believe that Jesus Christ walked on water, or he raised Lazarus from the dead, or he, you know, died and then, you know, and then was resurrected and sat on the right hand, that's all magic. And you either believe it or you don't, and it's your faith or it's not your faith. And I don't condemn anyone for what they believe, and I don't ridicule anyone unless it hurts somebody, unless somebody gets hurt. Then I have a problem with whatever your faith is or whatever your beliefs are. But, I mean, we are all alone in some way. And when I look at the National Cathedral, which holds 3,000 people, or the large mosques or synagogues, and I think every one of those people is thinking or is praying to a different God, whatever concept they have of what or who she or he is, they're all praying something. They all have their own personal faith. And that I read this wonderful book called A Religion of One's Own, and it was just so, it was sort of, I had an epiphany when I read it, because I thought, I have my own religion. I made it up. it's what I've taken from all other faiths and things that I've taken from my own life and created a belief system that works for me. And that I think that, you know, that you wouldn't recognize it. Well, actually, I've written about it. So people, but the interesting thing is that when people read my book, I'm just stunned at how many people come and say, you've spoken to me. You've told my story. This is how I feel. You know, I was brought up this, Catholic or Jewish or Hindu or Buddhist or whatever it might be, or atheist, but you've actually articulated exactly what I'm feeling, which is this personal faith, which has been, and, you know, that I have this wonderful line in the book about faith is like a blind man walking into a darkened room looking for a black cat and finding it, you know. I mean, faith is so personal, and nobody has the same faith. And it's my faith that's gotten me through. And so whatever my religion is, all of the things that I've learned all through my life, including, you know, my occult background, are just as legitimate as anything else and just as meaningful to me.
Right. No, I love an ally, Steve Behrman's quip. He goes, sure, it works in practice, but does it work in theory?
Mm-hmm.
Right? And so that's always been your love of astrology. And I would also just say about Nancy Reagan's astrologer, the most important thing she did was she really did talk to Nancy and Ronnie through that and say, Reagan, you've got to drop this evil empire thing because you and Gorbachev can really pull off something good.
Yeah.
She really did do that.
Yeah.
Right. So you know, so again, you know, there was, you know, there all of that. Anyway, so we bring that into play. But I also want to, you know, honor the timing of your book and your life, because I have talked to lots of people who, because you do praise me wonderfully in the book, who've gotten in touch, right? And they love your book. And just as you were saying, you know, it's contributing to an atmosphere of liberation where people can feel their own, you know, the word heretic was a term of praise in early Christianity because it meant free thinker. Boy, that's Ellie Quinn,
yeah.
Sure is. Oh, no, it's really good. Boy, that Silly Quinn sure is a great heretic.
Mm-hmm.
It was a good thing because it means free thinker.
Mm-hmm.
Only later, when the liberating teachings of Jesus were kidnapped by Paul, whom a political,
right,
spiritual friend of mine calls the early Karl Rove, you know, into servitude to the state.
Was, I love that. That's so, you know, perfect.
Was,
yeah.
Was, It is perfect, right? Well, because that's the sneaky suspicion of orthodoxy, you know, which is that it sucks joy out and creates a priesthood, which is an external authority. And where we've danced and where you are really is, you know, guiding yourself and others to their own autonomy, you know, and that's, you know, what you've done with your beloved son Quinn and yourself guiding to own autonomy. And that's always how I've attempted to work astrology with you, which is, you already know, Sally, we're guiding you to your own autonomy, you know, even when there are these challenging questions of what will happen. We go, well, what are we going to make happen? Here we go. That's right. So, yeah, so there's that. But especially now, it is so timely now, you know, and even at your book party with famous and important people and whatnot, you know, there was an atmosphere of expanded permission for feelings and thoughts.
Mm-hmm.
Not with everybody. There were still some very important, you know, grown-up guys there who were like, blah, blah, blah. But around the edges, there were unlikely people having profoundly open and mystical and wondering conversations.
Yeah.
And we just want to kind of spiral that out into everything, going, more room for everybody, more freedom, less, you know, less orthodoxy. What do we want to toss into the cauldron and ladle out, which is great. But you do grow up with rituals, as we do. You mentioned that your family, you moved so much with your dad and your mom. You know, and you say when we moved into a new house, we would always greet the house. Hello, house. You know, and bless it.
Mm-hmm.
And always have a welcoming party. And, you know, it's like from the afternoon, your interview with Carol Joint. But we just say a ritual is any physical thing we do that we imbue with dedicated symbolism. So you do grow up with ritual. I mean, you're a ritual person.
Being an army brat too, there's so much ritual in the military, you know, taps and, you know, reveille and you know, the military parades and all of that kind of thing was, and which I had, you know, I'd sort of looked down on ritual, thinking it was sort of mawkish and overly sentimental until I began to realize how important the rituals that I was participating in were to me, and I hadn't sort of thought of them as formal rituals, you know.
Well, it's tricky. We might want to make the interesting discernment between ritual and ceremony, you know.
Yeah, well, that's true.
I mean, because some of the military is ritual. I find, you know, at my grandparents' summer camp where they played taps is very moving. Day is done, gone the sun. It's it's a powerful ritual that's authentic. And then there are ceremonies that might not be leading people to their own autonomy. It's a little bit different. That's the kind of formal aspect of religion.
Well, I think if you look at Kim Jong-un and the people who are marching in front of him, that is not what I call ritual. That's ceremony.
Ritual. No, that would be an imprisoning Orthodox ceremony. But again, anything that's anywhere is everywhere. And we go, ooh, you know, Kim Jong-un and, you know, and Trumpelstiltskin, you know, very related. I want to bring it back to you because we've outsourced leadership and to sociopathic, uninitiated Mars boys. And everybody, you know, even I mean, there's unlikely allies now, right? Because even the Republicans are going, oh, now it's gone too far. And we do want this equal Mars Venus. We want to define what we want in leaders. And I did, you know, before we began, I did like the Umbepo, which is the Muti from South Africa, to just open up conversing between the living and the dead, because we experiment. Why not? Here we go. So, you know, Ben would be in the thick of this, wouldn't he? I mean, or maybe he is. What do you think Ben's counsel would be to our crazy state of democracy now?
Well, so many people ask me that, and the thing that that Ben hated the most was lying, and he actually started writing a book about lying, and then his mind started going, and he wasn't able to finish it. But in the Washington Post, they dedicated this room to Ben, a story conference room where they meet all day, every day, to discuss what's going to be in the paper. And there's a huge two-story wall right outside of it, and there's a big, gigantic quote on the wall from Ben that says, I should know it by heart now, but it says something to the effect of, the truth, no matter how painful, is always better than a lie, you know. You know, that's one of the things that got him so much about the Nixon administration, you know, because he ran the Watergate coverage at the Post. But I think he would look at the situation today, and I think he'd be conflicted, because, you know, nothing Ben loved better than a good story. And this is a fantastic story. So I think that, you know, from a professional standpoint, Ben was never ideological. I mean, he would be saying, let's get out there and let's get the story. Let's get it first, but let's get it right. And he would be on it. I mean, he would be working 24/7 and you know, really thriving on the job he was trying to do, which was to uncover the truth. But I think, you know, Ben fought in World War II. He was a tremendous patriot. He loved this country. And I think he would be appalled at what's happening now. And I think this whole attack on the First Amendment, on the press, the lying media, you know, the fake news, the enemies of the people, I think he would be outraged by that, and I think he would be appalled by that, and I think he would be very disturbed and discouraged to see what was going on in our country.
Well, you know, even, you know, in a quirky thing of astrological charts is they continue to respond even when somebody's dead.
Really?
So I did note this. Here we go. I did note the symmetry of our, oh, you know, and going, you know, genius is scheduling us always. And I'll say these things and then translate them. So when you're born, you are double Cancer with the rising sign of 5, Aquarius. When Ben's born, his rising sign is 5, Scorpio. My Mercury is 5, Scorpio. Jupiter in the sky right now is 5, Scorpio. So there's a Watergate resonance. And so in whatever in mysterious way, you know, we go, his chart is humming. And even as a historic reference, I mean, there's a lot of Watergate hum, but we just go in mysteries. I never presume to know about death or what happens to us, but there are these mysterious to and fro connections. And I know you did go to a medium after Ben died from mm-hmm. a reliable recommendation, and that felt authentic to you.
Yes,
right?
It did. Yeah. No, I mean, this woman whose husband was a journalist died, and she was a journalist and was totally skeptical of anything that had to do with, you know, mystery or, you know, so astrology, psychic phenomena, anything. But she was in such a state of grief that she went to this medium, and the medium put her in touch with her husband. And she spent a year working on a piece and interviewing this woman and talking to her husband through him, and wrote a piece about it, which someone sent me. And so then I contacted the woman, and I spoke to her 3 times, and then spoke to me through her, and I had the same experience she did, which was I was just completely blown away because she knew so many things about me and us and our relationship and experiences and people that we knew that she had no way of knowing, you know. And it was extraordinary. And interestingly enough, she didn't want. She said Ben didn't want to talk to me right away, and he didn't think I was ready. But she did tell me a few things that he said that were just extraordinary, and I was hysterical. I cried. I couldn't stop crying the whole time she was talking to me. And then she said, call back in a month, and I couldn't bear it because it was, I mean, I was on one hand ecstatic that I had felt like I was in touch with Ben, but on the other hand, even more sad because he wasn't there. And then I did call back about 3 months later, and I had a long conversation with her in which she relayed a number of things that Ben was saying to me through her, which were extraordinary. And then I waited for a long time, and then I think about a year later I called her, and she said, Ben wants this to be the last conversation. So I haven't spoken to her now in over a year.
But that's very him, isn't it?
Yeah.
I don't want to talk to Sally.
You don't, you know, you don't need this anymore. You know, I'm
right.
You know,
right.
I've said what I have to say. I've told you I loved you. You'll always be my girl, you know. And then it was kind of like, I think he wanted to help me let go. And so whatever it was incredible. And do I believe it? Well, I don't know. I mean, I just have the evidence that she knew things about me and him that no one could possibly know. And then, whatever does it mean?
And,
I don't know.
Well, we are pattern tracking beings, you know, through the mystery, and so we would just say that right now, today, you, mm-hmm. me, him, you know, mm-hmm. and resonating out into the world, he has a lot to say through you, or he loves you, or however we want to think about that. And I was looking at the letter I wrote you in 1982, and I was like, God, I certainly was a know-it-all in a lot of ways too. But I mean,
but it was really smart because when I did my book, I went back and read every single letter you wrote me. And they were
some of them were great.
Incredible. Yeah, I know.
Right. and some of it was like, God, I'm so bossy and telling people to do things that I'm not doing, but and read this and sit up and do that. And I don't do that so much. But I remember, I mean, you were in a particularly difficult place, you know, with Quinn and Ben. And I just wrote, you know, I remember, these are typed letters, right? From way over in the edge in California in a trailer above mm-hmm. you know, north of Santa Barbara, little outpost, lobbing these things to you. Just saying, I remember distinctly that during your pregnancy, you were conjuring the image of you and Ben and Quinn sitting on the beach.
Yeah.
Why not carry that image full cycle and go there? continue with the image until you get there, seeing everyone as they should be. Quinn Rosie with his own inevitable earthy vitality, Ben as relaxed as you can possibly imagine, and you full of the peace of the wise visionary who has brought it about. We were always talking to that part of you, Sally. And then just as I typed that, I go, the phone just rang with you on the other end saying that you're about to go off to the beach. And I go, very darling. We were always... yes.
Well, I was about to say, you know, you were talking about, do you think that Ben, even in death, is there are people, your church still goes on? And I thought, what is happening right now is such synchronicity, because my book has just come out where I write about Ben a lot. And now next week is the premiere of an hour and a half documentary about Ben. HBO's doing it, called The Newspaper Man, which is going to be all about Ben and the First Amendment and freedom of the press and truth. And then Simon & Schuster is reissuing his book, A Good Life, about his life, and with a new foreword by Woodward and Bernstein, and afterward by me. All about the freedom of the press and his life, you know, the Watergate. And then Steven Spielberg is doing a movie in December on the Pentagon Papers, and basically. And Tom Hanks is playing Ben, and Meryl Streep is playing Katharine Graham, and it's about facing down the president, who is threatening to close down the paper and, you know, take television stations away and, you know, throw everybody in jail because they're printing stories that, as Ben said, it's not about national security, it's about national embarrassment. And so all of this is happening now in a three-month period.
It's perfect. We're on our way out all too soon. But yes, Jupiter is transiting Ben's chart and yours and embracing you so that your memoir, Finding Magic, Sally Quinn's really wonderful spiritual memoir, is wafting out there at the perfect time. And Ben has a lot to say from the ancestral realms as well. So thank you so much, Sally Quinn. And we will be cahooting pretty soon again. And you can find Sally's book by just searching Finding Magic, and it will come right up. Thank you very much, Sally.
Thank you, Caroline. Fantastic.
That's great. Next week, wonderful. Next week, we will have Egyptian poet Yahya Labavidi, and after that, we will have CIA whistleblower John Kiriakou. I'm Caroline Casey. You can find me on Patreon, Visionary Activist Show, CoyoteNetworkNews.com. Thanks always to Erica Bridgman, and we will reconvene next week. Thank you, team.